So is anyone going to be using the hearing assistance? Believe it or not, it's still working. You just don't see it up here. It's connected directly to the amp back there. So if anyone would like to do that, there's a suitcase over in the corner with headphones and a receiver. So no matter what our original motivation for practice, no matter what our aspiration is for our practice, most of us came and continue in this practice because of suffering of some kind or another, some sort of low-level discontent or existential angst or out-and-out misery and everything in between. And this is the right place to be, because the Buddha said, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. So he did this in many ways, one of which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, the teaching of the two darts, for those of you that weren't here, sometimes also called the two arrows. First arrow being unpleasantness in life, there's plenty of that. And the second arrow being our thoughts about that. Cause ourselves misery. We pile on ourselves by aversion, resistance. This particular formulation talks about seeking escape from the unpleasant by seeking delight and sensual pleasure.
Cake.
Candy canes, you know, whatever your seasonal favorite is. The formulation that we'll talk about tonight is a little different. If anybody wants some handouts from a couple weeks ago, I've got a few extras here. You can see there's more than two arrows. It's like tonight's teaching, it's sort of a cycle. One thing adds to another, and each one is painful. So what we're talking about tonight is one of the core teachings of the Buddha. And it's one of those teachings where many of his teachings, he took the beliefs of the day and he kind of turned them on their head, or he twisted them sideways, so that his listeners who were familiar with the Brahmanic teachings of the day would get the words. And then, you know how advertisers sometimes will use cognitive dissonance, you know? You'll think you know where they're going, and they'll kind of twist something on its head, and you remember it. So he taught that way. He would take a concept like kamma, which is called karma in Sanskrit. He'd take a concept like that, and he'd just kind of twist it on its head for his own purposes, to teach about suffering and the end of suffering. This particular teaching is not one of those. This is one of the original teachings that he came up with that was not around. Now, he claims he didn't discover, he didn't invent anything. He says his teaching is like an old city in the forest. Kind of like, I always picture, when he says that, I always picture Tikal. You know, this ancient city in the forest that someone stumbled upon that had been lost for a long time. So he didn't actually claim that he invented any of this, but this is one of the teachings that did not spring directly out of the religious environment of the day. And it's called dependent origination. What it is, it's a form of causality. So there's what he called general causality, and it's quite simple. He explained it as when this, then that. When this happens, that happens. When my coworker calls me a blankety blankety blank, I call him a blankety 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 blank. That's direct causation. You know, when El Nino acts in a certain way, K California gets less rain. When California gets less rain, fires start. Okay, so direct, when this happens, then that happens. General causality. What he taught with this particular teaching of dependent origination is a specific way that our experience unfolds. And I'm not going to get into it in huge detail tonight, so I've provided on the handout the 12 links or nidanas of dependent origination. This is the way it's taught most commonly. There are multiple versions of these 12 links scattered throughout the Pali Canon, the place where his teachings were recorded. And there's an entire section of the Samyutta Nikaya, one of the books, that's called the Nidana Samyutta. All the suttas in there, all the discourses in there, are about dependent origination, every single one of them. So you can get a wide variety. For those of you that did read the chapter that I recommended in the write-up, both in the e-news and on the website, the chapter in here, all of those suttas were taken from that Nidana Samyutta. Now, as Diane mentioned the last two times that she's taught, the older scriptures are sometimes much less formal than this. They're much less tweaked to be easy to memorize, which is why a lot of the teachings end up sounding really formalistic, really formulaic, as these often do. And she talked about the Atthagavagga. In that same section of the Pali Canon is the Sutta Nipata. There's a formula for dependent origination that's completely different. It has 8 links, and it's explained in really natural language. So I forgot to bring the reference for that, but there's only one that's in that format. It's in the Sutta Nipata. I can get it to you if you drop me an email. The way that we teach in our beginning class is, we call it the cycle of reactivity. And it's a really practical teaching. And this year when we were teaching in the class, it just really occurred to me, this is a very helpful teaching. I find it personally helpful. It's one of the ways that we can really apply these teachings in daily life. And when you work with it long enough, you really start to notice, first of all, you start to notice harmful patterns earlier and earlier in the cycle. And there's two good things about that. One is that you're less likely to end up saying or doing something that you regret. And the other thing is, the earlier that you notice something in this cycle, the easier it is to refrain from doing something harmful at all. So that's the main thing of that I want to talk about tonight, is this cycle of reactivity. And all of these teachings about how suffering unfolds, which is what dependent origination is, the causality that causes us to be miserable, all of these teachings are not taught so we can be better at being miserable, right? They're taught so that we can get out of it. So when he says, I teach suffering and the end of suffering, that's what he was saying. I teach suffering, the reason I teach it is so that we can end it. So on the chart on the bottom, the cycle of reactivity on this handout, let's start with feeling tone. So the intuitive reaction of the mind on any experience, and by experience I just mean anything that comes in through the 6 sense doors, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, both external body and sensations in the body, and then thoughts and emotions in the mind. Those are the 6 sense doors. That's the only way you can experience anything. Kind of makes it nice. You only have to pay attention to 6 processes. So the intuitive reaction to anything coming in through those 6 sense doors is a feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Usually pleasant or unpleasant. Neutral's not all that often. We're pretty opinionated. Now, pleasant is very subtle, and it doesn't take much for it to escalate into the next box. So pleasant, if it's not seen and paid attention to, will escalate into desire. Unpleasant, if it's not paid attention to, will escalate into aversion. We don't like unpleasant. And neutral, if it's not noticed, will escalate into indifference. Another manifestation of that is boredom. So if those aren't noticed and worked with, there's attachment. Now, attachment, we just use a single word here, but the attachment that goes along with desire feels a little bit different than the attachment that goes along with aversion. So let's just stick with one thing at a time. So let's just stick with pleasant. So we get a pleasant experience. We want more of it. That's the tendency. That's the nature of the mind. We want more of the pleasant, and therefore we have desire. We desire more of the pleasant. Now, there is healthy desire. I was talking earlier about the aspiration for our practice. There's actually a different word for that in Pali, which is kind of nice. In English, we use desire, whether it's desire for something wholesome or it's desire for something unhealthy. But there's a word chanda that means desire for wholesome things. But that's not what we're talking about here. Here we're talking about this word tanha, which, as you can see from above, the literal meaning of it is thirst. So it's that craving for either for something to happen or for something to go away. In the case of desire, we want something to happen. We want more of that thing. And so what we become attached to is the idea that if we don't get that thing that we want, we're not going to be okay. That's when it escalates from just the feeling of desire. And when we start working with this enough, you can actually experience the feeling of desire without having it escalate beyond that. But when it does, when you say, if I don't get that thing I want, I'm not going to be okay, that's attachment. That's a sign that there's some attachment. It's gone from I want to I need. It's kind of a language you might look for in your self-talk, is when something goes from I want the latest gizmo to I need the latest gizmo or I'm not going to be okay. That's a sign that attachment has happened. Attachment, as Tony Bernhard always says, attachment isn't something that we do. It just happens on its own. So if you're saying to yourself, let go, let go, let go, that means you're already attached. Right? So attachment, if it's not noticed and worked with, and again, as I said before, it's getting harder and harder now to notice and work with it. At the level of feeling tone, it's hard to notice it, but it's not that hard to work with it if you can notice it. At the level of desire, it's still possible, but getting more difficult. The level of attachment, it's really difficult to get out of this cycle at this point. So what happens next is identification. And that's simply conflating the desire with me. You know, a self arises that says, I need this to be okay. I need this. And the I is at the center of that desire. I need this to be satisfied. So basically all of our resources are marshaled to be sure we get that thing. And so that's really what we mean here by identification. It's sort of putting ourselves at the center of our world, which we aren't. I hope that doesn't surprise anyone. We actually aren't the center of the world. Feels that way sometimes. When it feels that way, identification is happening. When it's all about me, I, me, mine, then identification is happening. And by definition, it's hard to get out of that because we're then the fish in the water. We see the whole world through the lens of me, And so our whole universe is defined. It's really hard to notice anything outside ourselves and our desires and needs because the identification, we've just really grasped onto, I need this to be okay, and if I don't have it, I'm not going to be okay, and if that person doesn't give me what I want, I'm not going to like them. And, you know, you start, each of these colors everything that's coming in. All of those six sensors that we are talking about, they aren't neutral. They're not neutral. The same sound, first of all, can be very different between one person and another. And second of all, can be different for one neural setup, you know, on one day versus another. You know, if you're tired, you know, sleep deprived, hyped up on sugar, and angry because you didn't get that new gizmo for Christmas, you're going to react to seeing the ad for the latest gizmo differently than if you're at peace and, you know, with good friends and all of that, and it, you know, you happen to notice it, it's just going to come in the eye and just go right back out again without having any stickiness to it. So when identification happens almost instantly, we're going to experience disappointment, suffering, and then that is going to be expressed as unskillful thoughts, speech, and actions. And that order is not accidental. Thoughts come first. The Dhammapada says, by our thoughts we make the world. So the thoughts come first. The thoughts will often lead to speech, and the speech will often lead to actions. Now, thoughts are a bit difficult to notice, especially when we're brand new to practice. That's one reason why when we teach this form of meditation, we do not encourage people to suppress or get rid of their thoughts. Getting rid of thinking is not the object of insight meditation. Noticing thinking is, and everything, every other experience, not just thinking, but actually it's very helpful to notice our thinking, first of all, because you don't have to work with it very long to realize most of it isn't true. Second of all, most of it's about me. When you really stop, well, let me rephrase that. When I really stop and look at what the thoughts are about that are going through my head, most of them are about me, about what I'm planning, about what I did that was so great, about, you know, what my next experience is going to be, about what I want and don't want. All of that, that's all going on. And if we can learn to recognize those and not believe them, we're going to be a step ahead on stopping this cycle. Now, hopefully, the first thing that we'll do is notice the unskillful thoughts before they've been expressed in speech. And often in here we'll talk about there's three times to practice, before, during, and after. So it's particularly applicable to this. With thinking, if we can learn to notice our thoughts, then we're practicing the during. During our thinking process, it's going on. If we don't learn how to do that, we haven't been able to develop that skill yet, then we're not going to notice the thinking until after we've said something that's unskillful. Because if we don't notice the thinking, it's going to get expressed one way or another. It may be in words. And maybe an action. Each of those has a greater consequence in that unskillful actions are usually more hurtful to the other person and to ourselves than unskillful speech. And unskillful speech is usually more harmful to others and ourselves than unskillful thoughts. So the Buddha talked about there's two kinds of suffering. The suffering that causes us more suffering, and the causes, the suffering that leads us back out of suffering. Unskillful speech is one form of suffering that can lead us out of suffering. When we say something to another person that we regret, you know, there's two paths. One is to say, oh, bad, bad person, I'm a bad person. You know, in other words, identification. Make it all about you. The other path is to say, ooh, I just noticed that person's face and their body language after I said that thing. That was really hurtful. I'm going to resolve not to do that again. Or if we're more realistic, not to do that as much. Or not to do it as loudly. Or not to do it in front of 20 other people. So that unskillful speech actually can be a form of suffering that can lead us out of suffering if we notice the consequences of our actions. Okay. So that's when we can actually break this cycle and have it unroll the other way. Unskillful actions, there are things that we do that stay with us the rest of our lives. You know, I've said a few things in my life that are still with me that I really, really regret, but my unskillful actions are much more sticky. They have much more consequence, both in terms of the harm to ourselves and others, but also in the power of the potential to do it again, which is another definition of karma, is that when we engage in certain actions, whether they're skillful or unskillful, we make it easier to do that again. If we tell lies, it becomes easier to tell more lies later on. You may have noticed that in the news lately. You know, and like Mark Twain says, you know, it's really better not to tell lies because you don't have to remember what you said. Because most of us, our memories aren't that great. So when we tell one lie, we've got to tell a few more to cover up for that first one, right? So you got to remember what you said, or you got to make up more lies to cover for the first one. I noticed today in the news that the Trump administration was trying to make up a bunch of stuff about Michael Flynn because they wanted to show that he was a liar. So we'll find out if the stuff they make up is true or not, but I just couldn't help but be struck by the irony of that strategy. So I just want to encourage you in practicing with this cycle of reactivity not to be afraid to actually notice the harm we cause. It's not easy. It's unpleasant. So the tendency is to shy away from it. The tendency is to have aversion towards it, to not want to do it because it is unpleasant. But to remember to frame it as the reason I am exposing myself to the unpleasantness of remembering those harmful words I said to that person is so that I can form a skillful resolve not to do it again or to do it less. So, you know, there is such a tendency to self-criticism in our society that sometimes we are afraid to go there. We're afraid to actually recommend to people, oh, notice the harm you've done to others. But it's actually a really productive practice to notice the harm we've done to others and to ourselves. If we can notice that, we can actually start to reverse this cycle. You know, we notice that our speech hurts somebody else. So all of a sudden, the identification that we're feeling, the fact that it's all about me, well, it's not all about me anymore. All of a sudden now it's about this other person. It's about noticing their feelings, noticing how they're reacting, maybe making a resolve to try to make some reparations or set things right with that person. You know, if we do that, we're letting go. By definition, if we're willing to take an action that we did and take responsibility for it, that in itself is a form of letting go. And that is also a form of saying, actually, that thing that I thought I really needed, my reputation or my comfort or whatever that I reacted against when that person spoke to me, I actually don't need that after all. I can be okay without that. It's more important that I set things right with this other person. So the attachment disappears. Now, the desire and aversion, they're not going to go away. They're just part of life. But if we can start to notice them earlier in the cycle, then it's going to be a lot easier to deal with them. If we don't notice them, then all these unskillful thoughts and actions are going to lead to more unpleasantness, which is going to just accelerate the cycle. And then we often come up with thoughts and emotions. Well, we don't come up with emotions. Emotions come up on their own. But then once they do, we come up with a bunch of thoughts that justify, oh, well, I may have said that to hurt that person, but by golly, they deserved it, and next time I see them, I'm going to double up. You know, make sure they really get the message. That kind of thinking, or they always is an idea that you've got an unhelpful pattern that is would probably benefit from being looked at. So just to get back and link this to dependent origination, a lot of these teachings in the beginning class are actually based on the base teachings of Buddhism, but we try to strip away some of that language for folks that are coming to us from a different place. But there's actually a one-to-one correspondence. So these first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, we don't talk about because they're all subconscious. They can't be noticed and worked with. So ignorance, the mental formations, consciousness itself, nama-rupa, which is the physical being and the mental being, if you will, process is better. The six sense bases I already talked about, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the mind. And then contact is when any object touches any of those sense doors. So when a sound touches the ear, when a sight touches the eye, when a physical sensation touches the sensing organs of the body, when a thought comes into the mind, when a smell touches the nose, when a taste hits the mouth. That's contact. You can't control that. Next thing to arise is feeling tone. And it's a really great thing to work with. It's very, very subtle, and you may not get it, but the more you try to work with it, the more you can actually notice your desire and aversion when they're at a very weak stage. So we say we're working with feeling tone. My personal opinion is that we're actually working with very weak desire and aversion before they really escalated up. But if you can do that, so this box is feeling tone. The desire, aversion, and indifference are the tanha, the thirst and the craving. The grasping is the attachment, upadana, which is literally means fuel. So think about that. You know, adding fuel to the cycle really starts to accelerate. Becoming is identification. In that moment, we become something other than what we were. You know, before that phone rang and we had that conversation, we were peacefully just doing whatever we were doing at our desk, working on our work and kind of in the flow of the day and doing whatever we were doing. The phone rings, we pick it up, the person on the other end says whatever they say, and we're off to the races. We have actually become something else. We've become a self is what we've become. But that's what birth is. Birth is actually the self arising in each moment. So this, you know, some people talk about this process being as if it's over multiple lives or something like that. It's not at all. This is all happening within a moment experience, all of this. It unrolls really, really fast. So birth is you know, when this self actually appears, and then old age and death, you know, we know about that. So that's the framing of it in the kind of context of a life. But in the context of this, every experience arises and then it passes away. And then it moves on to something else. Generally more ignorance. Because every time that we act unskillfully, we're strengthening our ignorance. We actually are ignoring the way things are in the world. So it's that kind of ignorance. It's not knowing a fact. The ignorance in this formula is not the lack of knowledge about certain facts. It's actually ignoring the way things are. And the way things are is that experience just unfolds on its own due to causes and conditions. You know, you've heard that many, many times, but these are the causes and conditions. This whole teaching is about the causes and conditions that cause us and other people to suffer. So life just unfolds. We're not controlling it. Sorry. But we're not. And as a result, suffering happens. So there's anicca, anatta, and dukkha. That's the way life is. Everything's impermanent, we're not in control of it, and as a result, we suffer. So, and not realizing that fact is ignorance, and when there's ignorance, this whole process is going to roll out time and time again. That's the way things will be until we start to actually master some level of turning this cycle back. There is one other, I'm only aware of one other formulation of how to reverse this cycle. So if you did the reading, there's the formulation that, well, you know, if you can get rid of ignorance, you can get rid of all of this. That was one formulation. The other formulation is, if you can prevent birth, then old age and death won't happen. If you can prevent becoming, then birth won't happen. If you can prevent fuel, grasping, then becoming won't happen. There's that cycle. So you just take this whole thing and you make it run backwards by removing the conditions is what you're doing. You're removing the conditions that lead to the causes. In simpler language, if we can actually notice identification or attachment or desire and aversion or pleasant and unpleasant and neutral, we can keep this cycle of reactivity from spinning out. There's one other formulation in the canon that is really cool, and I did a home retreat just before Thanksgiving, and it's by accident, I'm not quite sure what was going on, but by accident I listened to all talks by women that week. So I listened to two by Kamala, I listened to a couple by Diane, and I listened to one by Meg Galler. So Meg is associated with the Insight Meditation community of Redwood City, where Gil Fronstahl and Andrea Fella and Andrea Castillo teach. And she's moved up to this area. She's up in Nevada City or Grass Valley or something like that. And we were alerted to that, and so we've invited her to speak. She was supposed to speak on January 11th, but something came up in her personal life. So she'll be speaking in March, and she's fantastic. Her specialty is the Terigata, which is the verses of the enlightened women that were around at the time of the Buddha. But she gave a talk. It was actually it would have been the Sunday before Thanksgiving, because I listened to it the following day. And so it's on Audio Dharma at Insight Meditation IMC's website, which is Dharma. What is it? Insight Meditation's website. Dharma.org is IMS. Audio Dharma is the subsection of it. Maybe they do have a separate web address for it. If you Google Meg Galler Audio Dharma, it'll come up. At IMC, yeah. Galler, G-A-W-L-E-R. Anyway, she gave this teaching on liberative dependent origination. So it's actually a completely different formulation than any of this. Doesn't have any of these 12 links. Well, it may have. No, it doesn't have any of these. It's all about the positive qualities that lead to freedom. So it's a completely different set of causes and conditions, and it's on the positive side. So, you know how sometimes we'll take the precepts and rather than just say, I refrain from doing harm, I refrain from stinginess, I refrain from doing sexual harm, I refrain from, that formulation. We'll do them in positive. I undertake the training to become generous. I undertake the training to be helpful. I undertake the training to be helpful in all my relationships. Well, in a similar way, this liberative dependent origination is a completely different way of looking at the end of suffering and at freedom. So rather than taking all these negative things and thinking, well, I got to quit doing that one and quit doing that one and quit doing that one, what it is it the positive qualities that we can cultivate that can lead to freedom. And it's things like, I don't have it memorized, and better just listen to her do it anyway. But it's things like, joy, which leads to happiness, which leads to concentration, which leads to insight, that type of formulation. So I would really recommend that particular talk, and it might be a way for you to get to know Meg and her work, and be prepared for her visit in March. G-A-W-L-E-R. Meg Galler. Very nice presentation style, too. I think we'll really enjoy her visit. So I am open for your comments, questions. Fred, would you mind passing the mic? Thank you very much to Fred for setting up the audio tonight. Someone else was scheduled to do it and couldn't be here, so it's nice to have some depth in the organization. I think you just need the one. And by the way, I forgot to acknowledge the setup volunteers, but now that Margaret's back, we can acknowledge her part. Who else helped you, Margaret?
Tom Vigren and Alan Gottlieb.
They're not here either. Okay. Wow, it's like magic. So it's probably a good time to say, if you can, please stick around just a little bit when we're done here and take all the chairs except those in the front row and put them in the back, and all, of course, any cushions and things that you picked up. Help our cleanup folks get out of here more quickly. So, questions, comments? You are being recorded, by the way, even though you can't see the recorder. It's also attached to the amp back there.
Excuse me. Thank you, Rich, for the talk. It was really reflective on stuff that I'm going through. And I noticed recently something happened that somebody said they were going to do something. They didn't follow through with their action. And normally I'd react. But this time I sat and paused and thought about it and said, it's okay. You know, because I was thinking, and then I went to my feelings, and I felt my feelings, and I thought it wouldn't be productive to say anything. So I didn't.
That pause is a real gift. You know, and that pause is what we often miss in our sort of rush around our daily lives. But so much can come out of that. Of that pause. Thank you.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Walk around here.
Likewise, thank you, Rich, for the great presentation. But the question I have is, as I was thinking about the causes of suffering and what we experience internally, and when we have harmed others, the practice of a forgiveness meditation. And I don't know if that's been added on late. You know, I'm referring to what's in, you know, many different authors have written about how to actually do that, where you forgive others who have caused harm. And when you've asked for forgiveness if you've caused harm, and then you've forgiven others who have harmed you, and then you forgive yourself. So, in that practice of forgiveness meditation, although it's already occurred, obviously, after the damage or the harm has been done, do you suspect that that has another way of enhancing the sense of, if you can catch yourself in that, the whole cycle of you know, the changes that we go through that cause harm? What's your opinion about that?
Definitely, yeah. The forgiveness practice as such was not in the original canon, but the monks would have a time when they would confess themselves things that they had done that harmed, that they felt in their opinion had harmed other people. So, and there was a process, I mean, even up to the point of certain acts were enough to get you kicked out of the Sangha. So there was a process of kind of confession, so the other end of forgiveness. But you can't do that sincerely unless you've forgiven yourself, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that ability to go to someone and say, I'm really sorry for what I did. I did this, first of all, to acknowledge that you actually did something harmful, and then to ask, essentially ask forgiveness, that process is extremely valuable for letting go of it. First of all, you have to acknowledge the harm, and acknowledging the harm, as I mentioned before, is one of the ways that we can learn from our mistakes, so to speak, the way we put it now. The way that it was framed at the time, the attitude of mind, was what they call the two guardians of the mind. It's Hiri and Otapa. It's this healthy remorse. The idea that, I did this and I really feel badly about that. Not badly where we're, you know, flagellating ourselves, but I understand that I caused harm and I'm going to resolve not to do it again. And then the other one is the recognition that because of how we've acted, we would be subject to disapproval by others. So it's kind of the internal and external version. And so it's called the guardians, because they protect us from continuing to do harmful actions because we recognize the consequences and want to do better. So that's a form, it's kind of related to forgiveness. Just like metta, you know, the metta practice that we do came out of the Visuddhimagga. And so the forgiveness practice we do, I think it's very skillful. It's, I don't know if it's, has it been around any longer than, Diane, do you know, is there any basis in something earlier than Western psychology for the forgiveness practice?
Not according to people.
Right. So it is something that we've added to it as it's come into the West, and we've recognized the value of forgiveness as we do it. And I think it's very helpful. Other questions, comments? Your last chance this year. Well, if not, then let's close with a cultivation practice on loving kindness, metta. As this year draws to an end, let's recognize the value of the three jewels, the Buddha himself and all those around him, men and women, that left us teachings of such value and their own personal example of how to live. The Dhamma, the teachings, both of the Buddha and others around him, and all those through the ages that have transmitted those teachings to us, and the many skillful teachers that are available to us in this day and this time. And particularly in gathering as a community tonight, let's recognize the value of the Sangha, both our householder community here, people dealing with the everyday challenges of sickness, of old age, caring for others around them, and also of the Sangha, the lineage going all the way back to the Buddha, of those, again, who have practiced these teachings and found some benefit from them. And whatever benefit we've generated, both from being here together tonight and from meditating together and contemplating the teachings, and also from our practice over the past year, both formal practice and daily life practice, including our service to the larger community, May it all be dedicated to reducing the suffering of all beings. May all beings be safe and protected, peaceful and happy. May all beings experience true ease in whatever that means for them. And may all beings truly in this lifetime be free of suffering. Thank you for your practice.